Thank you for being an amazing supporter of the 10X Podcast Group, home to the history of the Caribbeans. We're excited to have you as a valued member of our growing community. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Your likes, comments, and reviews mean so much to us. They help us reach a wider audience and inspire us to keep sharing these incredible stories. With new episodes released daily, your feedback plays a crucial role in shaping our content and making it even better. Your dedication and enthusiasm drive our mission to document and celebrate the rich history of the Caribbean. We're deeply grateful for your support. Today, we're thrilled to present Honduras Episode 1, a captivating story tracing the journey from the island's earliest settlers to the present day. So sit back, relax, and join us as we guide you through this fascinating chapter in Caribbean history. Enjoy the journey. Chapter 1, The Rise of the Ancient Civilizations, 2000 BCE, 1500 CE. The land we now call Honduras was once a cradle of civilization, a land of towering mountains, deep river valleys, and lush forests that provided shelter and sustenance to its earliest inhabitants. Before the arrival of the Europeans, before the conquests and revolutions, before the modern borders that define nations, there existed an ancient world of ingenuity, culture, and empire. The indigenous civilizations of Honduras, most notably the Lenca, Pesh, Taliapan, and Cortes, shaped the landscape with their myths, traditions, and architectural marvels. This chapter delves deep into their origins, achievements, and eventual decline, focusing on the rise and fall of Copan, one of the most significant city-states of the Maya world. The first settlers and early cultures. The earliest evidence of human presence in Honduras dates back more than 10,000 years, when nomadic hunter-gatherers roamed the region in search of food and shelter. These early peoples, often referred to as Paleo-Indians, left behind traces of their existence in the form of primitive stone tools, cave paintings, and burial sites. Over time, as climatic conditions stabilized, these groups transitioned from a nomadic lifestyle to settled agricultural communities. Corn, beans, and squash, the three sisters of Mesoamerican agriculture, became the foundation of their diets, marking the dawn of organized society. By 2000 BCE, the indigenous cultures of Honduras had begun to coalesce into distinct groups with unique identities. Among them, the Lenca were among the most prominent. Though not directly linked to the Maya, the Lenca developed an advanced agricultural society with strong trade connections across Mesoamerica. They built ceremonial centers, crafted intricate pottery, and developed a rich oral tradition that preserved their history and cosmology. Further north, the Pesh and Taliapan peoples occupied the dense forests of present-day Honduras. Unlike the city-building Maya, these groups maintained a largely semi-nomadic existence, relying on hunting, fishing, and shifting agriculture. Their spiritual beliefs were deeply tied to nature, with sacred groves, waterfalls, and caves serving as places of worship and reverence. The dawn of the Maya influence. The most profound cultural and political influence on ancient Honduras came from the Maya civilization, whose presence in the region became increasingly significant around 1000 BCE. The Maya were master astronomers, mathematicians, architects, and artisans, and their knowledge and innovations gradually shaped the societies they encountered. The Maya expanded into Honduras, particularly in the western regions, where they built settlements and introduced advanced techniques in agriculture, writing, and governance. The pinnacle of Maya civilization in Honduras was undoubtedly Copan, a city-state that would grow to rival the great metropolises of Tikal, Palenque, and Caracol. The glory of Copan. Located in the fertile valley of western Honduras, Copan emerged as a major Maya city-state around 426 CE. The city was ruled by a powerful dynasty of kings, beginning with Yaxcuc-Emo, a warrior king believed to have arrived from the central Maya region of Tikal. Under his leadership, Copan flourished, becoming a center of art, astronomy, and religious devotion. The city's rulers commissioned vast stone pyramids, ceremonial plazas, and intricately carved stelae that depicted the divine right of kingship. The Maya of Copan developed one of the most sophisticated writing systems in the pre-Columbian Americas, using hieroglyphs to record historical events, rituals, and astronomical calculations. At its height, Copan boasted a population of over 20,000 inhabitants, with a well-organized class system that included nobles, priests, artisans, and farmers. The elite lived in grand palaces decorated with elaborate friezes and sculptures, while commoners labored in the fields to sustain the city's economy. Religion played a central role in Copan's society, with temples and ball courts serving as focal points for ceremonies, including bloodletting rituals and human sacrifices meant to appease the gods. The decline of Copan and the Maya collapse. Despite its grandeur, Copan began to experience a decline in the 8th century CE. A combination of factors contributed to its downfall, including environmental degradation, political instability, and prolonged warfare. Evidence suggests that deforestation and soil erosion led to agricultural crises, making it increasingly difficult to sustain the growing population. The reign of the 13th ruler, Waxaklajuan Uba Kawil, commonly known as 18 Rabbit, marked a turning point for Copan. In 738 CE, he was captured and executed by a rival ruler from the neighboring city-state of Quirigua, dealing a devastating blow to Copan's prestige. Although the city continued to be inhabited for several generations, its power waned, and by the early 10th century, it had been largely abandoned. The decline of Copan mirrored the broader collapse of the Maya civilization, which saw many of its great cities abandoned by 900 CE. Scholars believe that internal conflicts, prolonged droughts, and resource depletion played key roles in the civilization's fragmentation. While some Maya populations continued to thrive in other regions, the golden age of Copan had come to an end. Legacy and survival. Though Copan fell into ruin, its legacy endured through the remaining Maya and other indigenous groups of Honduras. The Lenca, Pesh, Taliapan, and Cortes adapted to the changing political landscape, preserving elements of their cultural heritage despite the disruptions caused by conquest and colonization. Today, the ruins of Copan stand as a testament to the ingenuity and sophistication of its builders. Declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 1980, the site continues to reveal new insights into Maya civilization through ongoing archaeological discoveries. The indigenous descendants of the ancient peoples of Honduras continue to honor their ancestral traditions, ensuring that the spirit of their forebears lives on. This chapter of Honduras history is not merely one of rise and fall, but of resilience and transformation. The ancient civilizations that once flourished in this land laid the foundations for the cultural identity of Honduras today, proving that history is not just a record of what was, but a living thread that weaves through time, connecting past, present, and future. Chapter 2, First Contact, The Spanish Conquest, 1502-1540s. Part 1, The Arrival of Columbus, A Fateful Encounter, 1502. The sky hung low and dark, the air thick with the scent of an approaching storm. The waves of the Caribbean Sea roared and crashed against the sides of four battered ships as they crept along the coastline of an unknown land. The crew, weary and half-starved, clung to the rigging, their eyes straining toward the distant shore, a dense, unbroken jungle that loomed like an emerald wall against the horizon. Christopher Columbus, the famed admiral of the Ocean Sea, stood at the bow of his flagship, La Capitana, gripping the rail as the wind howled around him. His face, lined with age and the weight of years spent chasing the edge of the world, remained unreadable as he gazed upon the land that would later be called Honduras. "We've found it," he murmured under his breath. It was his fourth and final voyage across the Atlantic, a journey fraught with hardship and mutiny. He had not come seeking new lands to claim, nor had he arrived in search of gold. He was a man on the run, desperate to salvage his reputation after falling from royal favor in Spain. As the ships dropped anchor near the bay that would later be named Trujillo, Columbus turned to his men, his sharp gaze sweeping across their tired faces. "Prepare the landing party," he ordered. "We will meet the people of this land." Part 2, First Contact, The Meeting of Two Worlds. The sun had barely risen when the first canoes appeared on the water, slicing through the waves with practiced ease. The indigenous people, tall, broad-shouldered warriors with skin the color of polished mahogany, watched the Spanish vessels with wary curiosity. Their ornate headdresses, decorated with bright macaw feathers, shimmered in the sunlight, a stark contrast to the dull, salt-crusted uniforms of the Europeans. They were the Corotega people, skilled traders and seafarers who navigated the Caribbean long before the Spanish had set sail. Their leader, a man of regal bearing, stood at the head of the largest canoe, his gaze fixed on the towering ships with an expression of both fascination and suspicion. Columbus stepped forward, his heavy boots creaking against the damp wooden planks. His men followed in silence, weapons strapped to their belts, hands twitching at their hilts. The two groups faced each other across the narrow strip of golden sand, the air charged with unspoken tension. Then, in a gesture of cautious diplomacy, the indigenous leader extended his hand. Columbus hesitated, then took it. The moment was brief, but in that instant, the fate of an entire land was sealed. The first contact had been made. Part 3. The Spanish Conquistadors and the March to Conquest, 1524. 2 decades passed before Spain's true army of conquest set foot in Honduras. The initial encounter with Columbus had left the land untouched, but where explorers hesitated, conquistadors would not. By 1524, word of the riches in the New World had spread across the courts of Spain like wildfire. Gold, silver, fertile land ripe for the taking. The greed of kings and noblemen knew no bounds, and the fires of conquest burned brighter than ever. The first to arrive was Gil Gonzalez de Vila, a ruthless commander whose ambition outmatched his ability. He landed near the Gulf of Fonseca, bringing steel and fire to the villages that resisted him. He was met with fierce opposition from the native Lenca warriors, and though he pressed inland, he was soon forced to retreat. But Spain was relentless. That same year, Cristobal de Olid, a seasoned soldier under Hernán Cortés, arrived with a force far greater than de Vila's. His mission was clear: conquer Honduras, crush all resistance, and claim the land in the name of Spain. He marched inland, his men armed with muskets and steel, while his horses, beasts the native peoples had never seen before, trampled the fields of maize beneath their hooves. Entire villages were set ablaze, the cries of the wounded and dying echoing into the night. For the Lenca people, led by the legendary warrior Lempira, the time for war had come. Part 4. The Battle of Lempira, the last stand of the Lenca, 1537 to 1539. Lempira was a shadow among men, his name whispered with awe and fear. He had risen from the depths of his people's suffering, a warrior whose rage burned hotter than the flames of war itself. He did not fight for wealth. He did not fight for power. He fought for the survival of his people. Under his command, thousands of Lenca warriors retreated to the mountains of Sirkin, where the Spanish could not reach them easily. From cliffside fortresses, they rained arrows and boulders upon the invaders. They fought with spears carved from the hardest wood, with knives of sharpened obsidian, their war cries shaking the very earth beneath their feet. For 2 years, Lempira held back the tide of Spanish conquest, his warriors unbreakable, unyielding. But treachery would undo what steel could not. The Spanish, unable to break the Lenca by force, resorted to deception. Under the guise of peace, they sent emissaries to negotiate with Lempira. But as the warrior stood atop the fortress of Peña de Sirkin, watching the Spanish delegation approach, a single musket shot rang through the air. Lempira fell. And with him, the resistance crumbled. Part 5. The Fall of Indigenous Honduras, Enslavement and Colonization, 1540s. With Lempira dead, the fate of the indigenous peoples was sealed in chains and suffering. The encomienda system was established, forcing the remaining Lenca, Pesh, and Cortes peoples into brutal servitude. The once proud warriors who had defied the Spanish now toiled in the fields and silver mines, their hands calloused and broken, their backs bent beneath the weight of Spanish oppression. Disease swept through the land, smallpox, measles, and influenza, killing thousands upon thousands. Villages stood silent and empty, the fires in their hearths long since extinguished. Entire civilizations vanished in a matter of decades, leaving behind only ruins and echoes of a world that once was. By 1545, Honduras was no longer a land of independent nations. It was a Spanish colony, a crucible of suffering and survival. The old gods of the Lenca and Cortes whispered their last prayers to the wind, and the land fell into the long night of Spanish rule. Chapter 3. The Colonial Yoke, the Spanish Rule, 1540 to 1821. Part 1. The Chains of Empire, 1540 to 1600. The Birth of Colonial Honduras. The Spanish flag, emblazoned with the golden lions of Castile and the Red Cross of Aragon, flapped in the humid wind over the land of Honduras. The conquest was over, but the battle had just begun, for the true conquest was not of land, but of souls, labor, and submission. For the Lenca, Pesh, Tlayupan, and Cortes, the arrival of the Spanish was not a single event, but an unending nightmare. Those who had survived the war and disease now faced a different kind of terror, the encomienda system. Under Spanish law, native inhabitants were forced into servitude, stripped of their ancestral lands, and placed under the rule of Spanish encomenderos, colonial landlords who claimed control over vast tracts of land and the people who lived on them. These landlords, appointed by the Viceroyalty of New Spain, treated their human property with brutality, forcing them to mine silver, harvest crops, and build Spanish settlements under the merciless sun. The once mighty city of Copan, once a center of Maya wisdom and art, was now a ghost of itself, abandoned to the creeping jungle. The great stone pyramids stood silent, their steps no longer graced by the feet of rulers and priests, but by weary slaves and Spanish priests, seeking to erase all traces of the old gods. But the land was not silent. It whispered with the rumors of resistance, of secret meetings in the mountains where the old ways still lived, where the last embers of rebellion smoldered beneath the ashes of colonial oppression. Part 2, The Silver Veins of Tegucigalpa, 1600-1700, Wealth and Blood. The year was 1578, and deep in the valleys of Tegucigalpa, silver was discovered. At first, it was a whisper, a secret carried on the lips of prospectors, men who had wandered the hills in search of fortune. But soon it became a roar. Spanish officials descended upon the land like vultures, and Tegucigalpa, once a sleepy outpost, became a booming mining town, feeding the vast wealth of the Spanish crown. Silver was the new god, and Honduras bled for it. Mines devoured the hillsides, gouging out the earth in search of veins that pulsed with the lifeblood of the empire. Indigenous men and African slaves, shackled and beaten, were driven deep into the tunnels, where they labored until their lungs turned to dust, until their backs broke beneath the weight of the empire's greed. The work was merciless. The Spanish used the mita system, forcing men into months of backbreaking labor, often leaving them blind from the dust, crippled by the weight of their suffering. The tunnels collapsed often, burying men alive in the cold darkness where no prayers could be heard. And yet, even in the darkness, rebellion flickered. Men who had nothing left to lose fled into the mountains, gathering in hidden enclaves where Spanish rule could not reach. Runaway slaves and escaped indigenous workers banded together, forming palenques, hidden communities of resistance. There, they planned attacks on the mines, sabotaging shipments of silver, striking back against their oppressors in the only way they could. Part 3, The African Arrival, A New Struggle for Freedom, 1600-1750s. As the indigenous population dwindled, ravaged by disease and forced labor, the Spanish turned to another source of human capital, Africa. The transatlantic slave trade brought a new people to the shores of Honduras. The Garifuna, the Afro-Caribbean descendants of enslaved Africans and indigenous Arawak people. Their journey was one of violence, displacement, and resilience. Captured from the shores of West Africa, shipped across the Atlantic in the stench of wooden slave holds, they arrived in Central America, their bodies bruised, their spirits unbroken. Many were sent to work the silver mines, where they suffered alongside the indigenous workers. Others were placed in Spanish plantations, harvesting tobacco, indigo, and cacao, commodities that enriched the Spanish crown. But the Garifuna people refused to be broken. By the late 1600s, many escaped to the Caribbean coastline, forming strongholds along the shores of Trujillo, Roatan, and the Mosquito Coast. They intermingled with Mosquito tribes and waged their own wars of survival against the Spanish, using the dense jungles and winding rivers as their shields. They sang songs of their ancestors, songs of rebellion, of lost homelands, of freedom, and though they had been torn from their past, they carved a new identity from the blood and salt of the Caribbean. Part 4, The Church and the Cross, The Battle for Souls, 1700s-1800s. While the Spanish claimed the land, they also sought to conquer the soul. Catholic priests flooded into Honduras, wielding not swords but the Bible, seeking to erase the gods of the past. They built missions and cathedrals, places where indigenous people were baptized, forced to confess their faith in Jesus Christ, and abandon their traditions. To the Spanish, the ancient gods of Honduras, Ixpayacoc, Huracan, Tepu, and the spirits of the Lenca and Maya, were demons. Their temples were desecrated, their sacred artifacts burned or stolen, their traditions outlawed. Yet, faith does not die so easily. In secret caves and hidden valleys, the old ways persisted. Families whispered prayers in the darkness, holding fast to the legends of their ancestors, weaving them into the very fabric of their Catholic beliefs, so that even in submission, they never fully surrendered. But the Spanish grip tightened. By 1750, the colony of Honduras was a land of three great struggles: the exploitation of indigenous and African labor, the resistance of escaped slaves and rebels in the mountains, the forced conversion and erasure of native identity. Honduras was no longer its own. It was a jewel in the crown of Spain, paid for in silver and suffering. But change was coming. Part 5, The Seeds of Revolution, 1800 to 1821, The Dawn of Independence. By the turn of the 19th century, the Spanish Empire was crumbling. Across the Americas, whispers of rebellion grew into cries for freedom. The revolutions in Haiti, Mexico, and South America spread like wildfire, shaking the foundations of Spanish rule. And Honduras was no exception. Tensions boiled in the streets of Tegucigalpa and Comayagua, where merchants, criollos, Spaniards born in the New World, and even some mestizos began to question why their land should continue to serve a distant king. The spark that would ignite the flames of revolution was near. The old masters of Honduras, the conquistadors, the encomenderos, the priests, could not see the storm that was gathering on the horizon. But the people could feel it. For nearly three centuries, they had endured Spanish rule. Now the time for endurance was over. The time for revolution had come. Chapter 4, The Struggle for Independence, 1810 to 1823. Part 1, The Seeds of Revolution, 1810 to 1818, A World in Upheaval. The world was changing, and the echoes of revolution reached even the most distant corners of the Spanish Empire. Across the Atlantic, Napoleon Bonaparte had invaded Spain, throwing the kingdom into chaos. The once mighty Spanish crown was weakening, and for the first time in three centuries, its colonies sensed an opportunity. In the north, Mexico was already ablaze with rebellion. Miguel Hidalgo, a priest with fire in his veins, rang the bells of his church and called for independence, igniting the Mexican War of Independence in 1810. To the south, Simón Bolívar and José de San Martín were leading their armies across South America, tearing down the walls of Spanish rule one battle at a time. Honduras, nestled in the heart of Central America, could no longer ignore the tides of history. The people, merchants, criollos, mestizos, indigenous leaders, and even disillusioned Spanish officials began to whisper of revolution. But whispers were not enough. A storm was coming. Part 2, The First Calls for Independence, 1811 to 1814. The unrest begins. In 1811, the first cracks in Spanish rule appeared. The city of San Salvador, the capital of the neighboring province of El Salvador, erupted in rebellion. Angry crowds stormed government buildings, demanding an end to colonial rule. Though this initial uprising was crushed, it sent shockwaves through the entire region. Honduras, long viewed as a quiet, obedient colony, now found itself at a crossroads. In Tegucigalpa, where wealthy silver mine owners resented Spanish taxation, small groups of revolutionaries met in secret, plotting their next move. In Comayagua, the colonial capital, Spanish authorities tightened their grip, issuing harsh decrees and arresting suspected rebels. But they could not stop the tide. By 1812, the Spanish monarchy, desperate to regain control, introduced new laws that allowed for limited self-rule in the colonies. For some, this was enough. But for others, those who had spent generations living under Spanish oppression, there was no turning back. They no longer wanted reforms. They wanted freedom. Part 3. The Rise of Francisco Morazan, 1815 to 1821, The Fire of Revolution. Among the young men who watched these events unfold, one name would rise above all others. Francisco Morazan. Born in 1792 in Tegucigalpa, Morazan grew up in a world where Honduras belonged to Spain, where indigenous people and the poor were treated as less than human, where wealth was hoarded by the colonial elite. But unlike the Spanish rulers, Morazan dreamed of something greater. He was charismatic, fearless, and relentless, a man who believed in a united Central America, free from foreign rule. In 1815, as Spanish forces battled uprisings in Mexico and South America, Morazan quietly built a network of allies, military officers, intellectuals, and revolutionaries who were ready to fight. For years, they waited. Then, in 1821, their moment arrived. Part 4, The Declaration of Independence, September 15, 1821, The Breaking of Chains. On September 15, 1821, a historic meeting took place in Guatemala City, the capital of the Captaincy General of Guatemala, which included Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Guatemala. After centuries of Spanish rule, a group of criollo leaders, influenced by the independence movements sweeping across the Americas, signed the Act of Independence. The decree was simple, yet powerful. The nations of Central America were now free from Spain. Across Honduras, church bells rang out. In Tegucigalpa and Comayagua, celebrations erupted in the streets. But not everyone rejoiced. The Spanish authorities, though officially defeated, were not willing to let go without a fight. And in the shadows, a new threat emerged, not from Spain, but from within. For independence was only the beginning. The real battle was yet to come. Part 5, The Mexican Empire and the Struggle for True Freedom, 1821 to 1823. Independence had been declared, but Honduras was not yet free. As soon as Spain lost control, another empire arrived, Mexico. Led by Agustin de Iturbide, a military leader who had declared himself Emperor of Mexico, the Mexican Empire claimed all of Central America as part of its territory. For some, this was a blessing, better to be ruled by fellow Latin Americans than by Spain. But for others, including Francisco Morazan, this was just another form of oppression. For 2 years, Honduras existed under Mexican rule, torn between those who wanted to remain part of the empire and those who demanded true independence. Then, in 1823, everything changed. The Mexican Empire collapsed. Iturbide, the self-proclaimed emperor, was overthrown. And with his fall, Central America was finally free. On July 1, 1823, the nations of Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica formed the Federal Republic of Central America, a fragile but hopeful experiment in self-rule. It was a new era. But even as the sun rose over a newly independent Honduras, the battles were far from over. For freedom is never given. It must be fought for, again and again. And as Francisco Morazan would soon learn, the greatest battles lay ahead.